BadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. Today is Friday, August 31st, 2012, and I have a very special treat today. I did an interview with Jeffrey Tucker, and it was a really good interview, and you're going to hear that in just a minute. The problem is Skype failed us. It cut in and out a couple times, and then close to the end of the interview, Skype just completely let us down and broke apart on us. So what you're about to hear is the best that I can edit it to keep the context of what Jeffrey was saying and get as much of the material as possible of our interview, and then the rest is going to be cut off. I will try to get a hold of Jeffrey as soon as possible and see if we can't get a second interview so that he can get his points across that we failed to be able to salvage from the audio of this interview. So that's my little apology for the bad audio. Here is the interview with Jeffrey Tucker. And with me today is Jeffrey Tucker. Jeffrey is the author of A Jetson's World, Private Miracles and Public Crimes, and he's the author of Bourbon for Breakfast, Living Outside the Status Quo. I have both those books. I've enjoyed both those books immensely, reading them over and over. It's the kind of book that you don't, both of them are the kind of book that you don't just read through it and then set it on a shelf. It's a regular thing that you can go back and re-enjoy regularly over and over. And I'm privileged that one of those two, Bourbon for Breakfast, is actually signed by the author. Mm-hmm. Jeffrey is also the executive editor and publisher of Laissez-Faire Books. Jeffrey, welcome back to BadQuaker.com podcast. You were on about a year ago. How's things been going for you?
Fantastic, and I have a new book out. It's called A Beautiful Anarchy, and it's similar to my last two, but I try to take everything to a new level in a way here, trying to deal more with solutions than problems, and trying to grapple with the meaning of the internet and the digital age in light of the prospects for human liberty. So and I think there's some new points and some new arguments in there, so that's kind of consumed a lot of me. And then moving over to Laissez-Faire was fairly big deal, as you noted. It's got a long history, but there were some problems that had cropped up, you know, after the advent of the internet. So we had to refurbish the business model and find new ways.
And you really did rescue that. Laissez-Faire Books goes all the way back to 1972, and it was kind of the New York hangout place for all the movers and shakers in the libertarian movement, Rothbard and all of them.
Yeah, it was. You know, I find it difficult to describe what that time was like to people. I mean, you know, people who have not been, you know, didn't enter into any kind of adulthood before 1995 find it inconceivable that information was so hard to get. I mean, information of all sorts was very hard to get. Yeah. So you couldn't really even find out that such a thing as Laissez-Faire Books existed, or that these ideas of liberty or libertarianism, a new way of thinking about politics and economics or anything else, existed. The only real way that you could get outside of your own neck of the woods, and you know, your professors, your friends, your parents, you know, your civic associations, was to go down to the local library and sort of dig around, or academic library, and if they didn't happen to have the thing you wanted, you were completely sunk. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily have even known what you wanted. I mean, this is how it comes to be that somebody like me just could have, you know, nearly disappeared, you know, or some of the other great thinkers, because it was a different time. In any case, what laissez-faire did was struggle very mightily to provide a kind of curation services for books of a certain sort, and that sort would be the kind that focus on the dream of human liberty, kind of reviving it out of the old liberal tradition and putting a new spin on it. So they were very broad-minded. They published books, but mostly they distributed books and they curated books. And it was a physical store, of course. And it became a kind of hangout, a place for sort of radicals that dissented from the left and the right, you know, which at the time there weren't too many, you know. But it gradually grew into a kind of a mail order business that was rather successful. And it was, it played a gigantic role in kind of forming what people call the movement, you know, in the sense of drawing attention to what ideas that matter and why they matter. So that was a huge role, you know, for one institution to do that all alone. And it went way beyond economics. You know, it touched on foreign policy during the Cold War and civil liberties and issues of, you know, drug legalization and, you know, all kind of far-flung topics, you know, to promote a kind of integrated understanding of human liberty. So that was then, and it really flourished under in what I like to call the analog age.
Yeah, and then you know, as important it was through those years, it really didn't adapt well to the internet and an expanded understanding of intellectual property laws that we now have, and it was really struggling there for a while. I really thought back. Oh, I'm going to say 2004, 2005. I thought, well, you know, any day I'm going to find out that it's gone. And so I was quite thrilled when I heard last year that you had taken it over and shifted the direction.
Well, you know, it was what had happened. It had fallen into several different hands. And I, you know, it's the easiest thing in the world to not make a business a success. So really, the people who took on the task of preserving the thing in those years when things didn't go so well, that doesn't mean that they did something bad. They did something good because they kind of, you know, preserved it and worked extremely hard, but it was very difficult to make a go of book selling. You know, in times when, you know, you didn't have the money to publish and you're competing against, you know, very progressive companies all over the place. But so it kind of passed from hand to hand. And then in 2010, the company that owns it now, Agora Financial.
Bill Bonner's organization.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was founded by Bill Bonner, and then and Addison Wiggin is the president of Agora Financial, and Addison and Bill Bonner have, there's a kind of an interesting thing here I'll tell you about. So part of, you know, every firm, you know, and this goes for corporations, it's not all about profits. They all have their own internal cultures and their own internal interests and things that they like to do. And one of the things Agora likes to do is acquire old properties, physical properties that have
old mansions.
Yeah, old mansions and old lots of things. And a lot of them are in Baltimore. I mean, there's a lot of buildings in the Mount Vernon area of Baltimore itself that are actually Agora properties now. They took them over and renovate them and use them for office space and use them for wonderful things. But they've not just done this in Baltimore. They've done it in many places around the world, you know, from, you know, Argentina and Nicaragua and France and, you know, the UK and everywhere. And so there's a kind of a corporate habit, you know, within Agora of looking for undervalued assets that have a kind of a legacy content that's spectacular, that is that needs discovery and refurbishing. So when they found out that laissez-faire was available, they looked at it like, you know, like you say, an old mansion that had been kind of abandoned, you know, and needed a little bit of tender loving care. So almost really on fly, they said, hey, let's get this and see what happens. And also, Agora had really hoped for a kind of intellectual infrastructure that to support the rest of their industry, which, you know, relies very much on education and distribution of ideas and marketing. But so this was an attempt to, it was the hope was that by acquiring the Laissez-Faire books that there could be, you know, a further kind of advance of the seriousness of the project. Now, the big change in this acquisition, what it meant for Laissez-Faire, and I think what it means for the libertarian world, was very obvious to me when the first time I talked to Addison about this, and he told me, he said, as far as I'm concerned, there are two great things in the world: commerce, it gives rise to productivity and efficiency and creativity, and really, you know, the most marvelous things in the world are created by commercial institutions. That's the thing that helps us live and thrive, and it's what drives history forward. Everything else is a kind of in the background, you know, lapping up the proceeds, you know. And he said, so the commerce, and secondly, the ideas of liberty that gave rise to, you know, that were important in his own life and so many other people that worked at Agora. So they wanted to see those ideas united with this kind of commercial spirit and bring them together and just see what happens. You know, just shove them together and watch the explosion and see what comes of it. And, of course, I'm listening to this thinking, wow, you know, I've had a long history of writing about commerce and writing about liberty, but the idea of bringing those two things together in practice and watching what happens to an institution. But I'll tell you something else. I was very curious to see what would happen to me, you know, as an individual, by plugging into this power source, really, that commerce is. I mean, it's a kind of a magical, creative power source with results you don't always expect. I mean, there's a surprise every day, you know, around the corner. The last time I had been involved in any kind of serious commercial enterprise, you know, in the sense that you rise or fall based on the metric of the balance sheet, you know, that kind of thing, was really, you know, when I was a teenager, when I worked in a whole series of fun places where, you know, I felt that burn, that sense of, wow, let's go get them. And there's it's an interesting thing in commerce. I mean, there's the relentless drive to kind of serve people better. I mean, that is so much embedded into the commercial framework that entrepreneurs just, and managers, you know, they just take it for granted. I mean, that's the fundamental principle of a service. And then that combined with a kind of sign and seal, I guess you could say, of a job well done that comes from the accounting, from the profit and loss sheets. So to you know, throw myself into that was again was very interesting for me, because it recalled a very deep history of my own life, you know.
Now, you had spent years over at the Mises Institute, and really were, a lot of people will say this, not just my opinion, but a lot of people will say that you were the driving force that set up the model of the Mises, how you go to the Mises Institute, what you see online, how you interact with it, get your hands on the PDFs or the audio files that are over there. And when you moved over to Laissez-Faire Books, you brought some of that same model, a little bit different, it's got a twist to it, it's a little bit different, but you brought some of that same model over there, and it, I think it really works at Laissez-Faire Books.
Well, thank you. You know, what's funny is that, you know, I had no idea just what I would be taking on, because, you know, the losses were mounting, you know, and there was really no obvious solution to it. And we've got a very long way to go. And when I look at our plans, I practically fall over and faint. It's so exciting. We're just now getting going in a way. But gosh, we've come so far so fast. It's just, extraordinary. But you know, here again, it's a little different from working in something like, you know, a foundation or a nonprofit or something like that, where, you know, there's, like I say, there's not a daily. There's no lines on the road in that world, but in the commercial sector there are very clearly planted lines, and you know exactly where you're headed. But it's a matter of, you know, having the fuel to get from here to there. That's a pretty good analogy. I just came up with that.
You better write that down.
I'll write that down. That's pretty good. But so that's true on one hand. On one hand, it's like driving. You've just got a fuel to go to get down the road, and we're getting there. And people are very impatient. You know, it's funny because I interact a lot with customers and what's going on, and everybody wants this and want that, and people have lots of great ideas, and I do too. But it's really a matter of kind of, we have to walk through the paces to get there, one step at a time. And I tell you, there's something else that I find thrilling about it. And so on one hand, yes, there's lines on the road, but on the other hand, there are always surprises. So you have to be prepared every day to change directions. You have to be ready to blow up the plan and take a new direction. And here's where an analogy I'm not coming up with here on the spot. It's one that I played with in my own mind. I was just daydreaming about it. So I think the right way to understand the commercial project is that, you know, we need to first understand that you're dealing with a world of change, right? I mean, tomorrow will definitely be different from today, and today is definitely different from yesterday. So a commerce that has to kind of fundamentally deal with realities has to be able to adapt to change. That's one thing. But the other thing is that a commerce has to be forward-looking, and the future you're looking into is unknown ultimately to you. You're having to make sort of like constant judgments about tomorrow based on little scraps of information you have based on the past. The past helps you. It doesn't actually tell you what to do. It only kind of informs your intuition, you know. So here's my analogy. I think it's a little like if you've ever been rock climbing, you know, on a real rocks, there's no symmetrical relationship between the place where you can put your foot and grab your hand. I mean, there are places out there, but the stretching could be a little longer, could be a little slower. There's a different technique on each one. There's a different way you have to set your foot. You don't, you know, going up is not just a matter of repeating what you did, you know, on the previous step. It's going to be a little different all the way up. Mm-hmm. But imagine doing rock climbing now with a blindfold on. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's what commerce is like for everyone, because you have an intuition about what might be there. You have a sense of memory of the shape of the rock or what's happened to you in the past, but it doesn't necessarily determine the future. So you're constantly feeling your way forward and up. And then, you know, another obvious element to this is that there's no nothing at the bottom to save you if you step
wrong. Yeah, well, as long as your business is honest and you're not relying on a government a net down there somewhere, which, of course, you wouldn't. That's not what we do. But
yeah, that's right. So anyway, so you can see that I'm having a lot of fun. I'm reading so many books, and we can get to that in a second, what it's like to run the Laissez-Faire Club. But what I'm finding is that just the practice of being involved here is teaching me things that used to be just kind of dry words on a page. I now see them, you know, in action. And so it's really invigorating in a way. You know, it's like hurling yourself into the thick of a commercial marketplace and dealing with a lot of really tactile issues and real issues. And it's very gratifying. The workload is absolutely astonishing.
I believe that.
But I got to tell you that, you know, institutions have a lot to do with how we perform day to day. You know, when lots of expected of us, we can do amazing things. And if if not much is expected of us, then, you know, we can easily fall back. So I've surprised myself. I mean, initially I thought, oh God, you know, I can't hardly do this. I'm out of breath. I'm out of thoughts. I'm out of I can't. But then you find it's just like, you know, it's like working out in a way. I mean, like the first time you run a mile, you think you're going to die, and then 2 months later you run 3 miles and pretty well, you know. So it's like that with creativity and work and sort of the work ethic that comes with the astonishing demands of enterprise. You know, you find yourself digging deeper and deeper and deeper, and doing more and more and more. And wow, you know, here's the other great thing about commerce: nobody cares about your complaints. And so when you know that that is ruled out, that all your whining and complaining amounts to nothing, then you just say, well, you know, I'm going to stop complaining. I'm just going to do it. It's great.
Now, this is normally the point, about 20 minutes into the interview, this is normally the point where I would pause the interview and we would inject a commercial. But what I'm going to do instead is, if it's okay with you, Jeffrey, I'm going to save this file and then come immediately back and talk with you about Laissez-Faire Club. And our commercial break today will be a commercial for Laissez-Faire Club rather than a commercial for Tom Wood's history class that he has over there. Okay, and we're back with Jeffrey Tucker. Just paused long enough to save the file. And Jeffrey, here's your free commercial for Laissez-Faire Books, the Laissez-Faire Book Club. How's that work, and what is it, and what does a person get?
So, well, you know, I had recalled when we were looking. This is I came to work November 1, 2011, and we were trying to figure out how to make this thing happen. It wasn't really a business plan, and we didn't really know. And we kind of there are a number of people that contributed to the ideas. There's no reason to go into it in detail. I mean, you know, in a firm like this, everybody gets together and we throw our ideas out there and critique each other and kind of extract ideas from each other. Anyway, the idea was that, in the Middle Ages, the most valuable thing in the world was a book. And it was more valuable than all the property on the monastery lands, more valuable than even land where agriculture took place. And a book was an amazing thing. With printing and then with modernity and, you know, all the great increases with the internet, there's no shortage of content. We're flooded with content. We're awash in content. And I had noticed something through the years is that people are almost intimidated by how much is available, and they don't know what to do about it. They're out of space in their houses. They're not really reading the books they have. They get exhausted just checking their email. And then they stop reading. I mean, it's one of the most ironic things about the digital age that that we have so much that's available, and yet people, I sense, I mean, based on my correspondence, and I've actually seen polls to this effect, that people are reading less and less, which is really very interesting. So, but knowing that people want to educate themselves in the same sense that you want to go to the gym, you know, you want to get in shape, you want to eat better despite the fact that, you know, there's plenty of food, you want to eat that kind of food. We decided to kind of invest in this idea that people want to learn, and that what people really need are really high quality resources that are curated for them, that can be delivered to them in ways that don't take up more space, that don't cost a whole lot of money for them to ship, and which come with explanations like videos and a community to talk about the books and something to provide them inspiration and guidance and a kind of a roadmap for self-education and for becoming a better, just becoming more enlightened and areas of political economy, philosophy, and law, and all the rest of it. So we put together the Laissez-Faire Club to do this, and it's a ridiculously low price. I mean, it's $10 a month, and for that, you're able to get the best quality DRM-free ebooks on a whole range of areas. We're uploading them every week, but with those uploads, it's not just like, oh, here's a weekly upload. No, we go to a lot of effort to summarize the book, to write essays about why it's important, to interview the authors, to interview people who are experts on the authors if it's an older work. I make a 10 or 15 minute presentation myself and kind of give my own personal response to the book and detail the takeaways. These are very high quality videos. And so we have this whole kind of infrastructure that goes along with each one. We roll them out a little bit at a time so that people aren't overwhelmed. They're overwhelmed anyway, but we do our best not to overwhelm people. And sure enough, I mean, it's been an enormous success. We're further along than I ever imagined we would be here at the end of August. And I'm so gratified to see just how much people really like the service, because it allows them to kind of calm down and sit down. It inspires them to put aside, the endless checking Facebook and actually open a book and learn from it. And, you know, if you take the time to do that, you wake up the next day and whoa, you know, you're more creative, you're smarter, you're energized. I mean, it's a way of kind of refueling you personally to really dig down and start taking ideas seriously. And I think it's a great secret of our age that people are not doing this. They claim to, but they're not doing it. And people need help. And that's what the club is all about. So I'm hoping to form this kind of global network of serious readers. It's like, you know, people have reading groups sometimes, and people have those because otherwise they wouldn't be reading. They don't have the inspiration. So if a reading group is there, you're all sitting around in a circle and you're able to talk about the book you're reading. Well, the idea is that within the digital age, we have the possibility of kind of expanding this model, combining the club, the reading group and the book club idea into a kind of geographically non-contiguous, global network of people who are taking ideas seriously. So that's the theory, and I don't know anybody else who's ever tried it, ever done it. I think there's one other digital book club on where they actually deliver the real thing with romance novels. It's the only other one I found or something, but in the libertarian area, we're the only guys, and we're working very hard at it.
Now, I should give a disclaimer, too, because what I said may have confused some people. It wasn't really a commercial, but yet it is a commercial for Laissez-Faire Club. It's not a commercial in the sense that you're not paying me to let you come on my show and say these things. I support what Laissez-Faire Books is doing, and I support what you're doing with the Laissez-Faire Club. And so I'm not charging you to come on here or anything like that. So we're not, just let the listeners know that this is not they're not listening to an infomercial
or
something.
Right. No, that's
this
right.
This is a product that I actually support and I'm throwing my tiny weight behind it. Well, I don't know. I'm not that tiny, but but I'm throwing my weight behind it because I believe in what you guys are doing over there. And I looked it over, and you get if you buy a full year, you get a discount, right?
Yeah, you get a discount. I think it's $10 a month, or you can just buy the whole year. And I think like 90% of the people could just go for the full year. And once you're a member of the club, you get things you can absolutely not get anywhere else. I mean, first you're hit with wow, this is great. We've got an edition of Economics One Lesson. And, I've asked top thinkers in every field to write the introductions and prefaces to these things. So we've got, the law and Hayek and Smolder works and some outstanding works. And we're also commissioning new works. So we, have a new work by Hans Hoppe coming out next week, and tomorrow by Gary Shanchet, which is just a great book called Conscience of an Anarchist. I've spent the last 4 days with this book, and I got a chance to interview him, and I, uploaded that interview online. I have all this incentive now to give every release the maximum amount of energy and time that I can to inspire people to take it on, and that's really cool. Instead of just sort of standing back and going, okay, here's your file, you know, take with it, do with it what you want. I'm in a position now to really help people through this process, you know, one book at a time. Now, from my own point of view, I got to tell you, it's funny. I mean, anybody who kind of knows my writing and knows my, I guess, you know, my sort of the way I work, I do tend to bounce from enthusiasm to enthusiasm. You know, I'm not one of these great systematic thinkers, you know, who writes the, you know, I'm not Rawls or something, you know, to say the least, or Hans Hoppe or Mises or any of these, you know, people, or, you know, I will never write a systematic treatise. It's just not the way I'm built. But I very naturally get extremely excited about whatever I'm doing at that moment. You know, that's sort of the way I am. I remember once when I was working at a furniture store. I hated furniture. So I could never sell the stuff. But the manager said to me, he goes, you know, you said you're a funny guy. You get wildly enthusiastic about whatever you happen to be doing at the moment. He said, you know, I only want to recommend to you that you never start taking drugs. He said, I think you would be, you would just be a calamity. I mean, you'd be the most catastrophic drug user, you know, ever. But anyway, so for me, my drug is ideas. And so every week I get to take on a new book. And you know, the books we're releasing are so exciting. They just consume me completely. Like, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I was living and breathing Albert J. Nock, you know, and his work, Memoirs of the Superfluous Man, which is very important in my own life. I mean, I remember, you know, I reread it for the club release, and I could remember my almost physiologically the feeling I had, you know, when I stumbled across passages I'd read for the second time. I remember what it was like to read them the first time, you know, that sort of sense of, you know, invigorating revelation, you know. So that was very exciting to me to go through that whole thing again. And then I did the same thing with Wendy's book, and I'm doing this right now with Gary Shanche's book, because we're releasing it tomorrow, Conscience of an Anarchist. So I'm steeped in this thing. One of the reasons, I guess, I really admire intellectuals a lot. I admire the ability for people to write and think and come up with new ideas and sincere, brilliant writers who can really take on a topic and provide a kind of a new insight that, and not just because it's a new insight, but because I believe that the whole world we see around us, you know, is built first from ideas long before anything, any natural resources are shaped into anything physical that we can observe. There had to be this vision in somebody's head, and it had to combine with somebody else's vision. And that, you know, I mean, that's the invisible reality, that everything you see is a result of ideas. Everything, I mean, the whole world is built by ideas, and the physical stuff we see is all built from old ideas in a way, and the physical world that we'll see in the future is being built now by the things that people are thinking today. So that's why it's so important, you know, and that's why ideas are so exciting, because when you're reading a great book, you're kind of getting an insight into what the world of tomorrow may look like. You know, that's really thrilling to me. So yeah, that's how I can get so excited about these things. So I am permitted and encouraged to pass on, you know, that sort of love and enthusiasm to people who would like to share it and would like to experience that same thing. And that's what the club has allowed me to do. So yes, it was put together as a kind of business proposition, and it's worked very well. But, I mean, from a personal point of view, I mean, I can't even imagine putting together a better model for me, you know, intellectually and professionally. It just plays into everything I truly love.
And that's a real important thing, to be able to do something that you can really enjoy and make a living doing it too. If you can get the combinations of those two things together, man, that is just really, and so many times, you know, people are stuck working a job they really don't like, or they really don't, you know, they're stuck in it. There's just circumstances that they can't do anything about. But if a person can figure out a way to break out of that and find that job that's out there somewhere waiting for them, you know, just like what you were describing there, the difference in what happens in your head alone is well worth the risk, because there's always a risk.
Yeah, and I would actually encourage, because I know that a lot of your listeners have a love for human liberty and an interest in these ideas. And it's funny, isn't it, how the commercial model, the commercial marketplace, has not really been central at all to the educational mission of libertarian ideas, the greatest ideological infrastructure for supporting commerce. So it's actually a funny thing how that's turned out to be over the years. But I would encourage anybody who's looking for sort of, you know, what do we do now? You know, what should we do in the future? Reconsider any plans you might have for political activism or going to work for you know, a purely educational kind of thing or whatever, and actually look at commerce, because it's good for your life experience. Now, you mentioned something earlier, not everybody has this opportunity, and I think that that's really tragic. I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, there's a lot of things about today's job marketplace that are seriously, seriously hobbled, and it's really a human tragedy. I mean, we've seen this. It's a young generation getting out of college, you know, they can't find jobs. They can't find jobs that are gratifying and satisfying to them, that pay them what they expected to pay, and have them doing what that they hope to be doing. You know, to me, this is truly tragic. And then you have other people kind of stuck in jobs, and they don't really know how to get out of them. I mean, there's this profound fear, you know, of leaving. And when you talk to people about it, you know, somebody who hates his job, you know, or you hate your job, you know, why don't you leave? Well, it pays well. But what if you find another job that pays well? But I don't know if I can find another job that pays well. Well, what's your biggest fear of taking a chance? The loss of health insurance.
Yeah.
That is a huge thing. And it really is very tragic, because that sort of gives... That the fact that the business is distributing health insurance, you know, the first impression might be that this is a kind of a worker right, you know, a benefit to the worker. Mm-hmm. Actually, what it does is it gives the employer inordinate power over their workers. I think about the left. You know, if the left really believed in empowering the workers, the very first thing that they would push for is to decouple health insurance from the businesses, because it gives unfair negotiating advantages to the bosses of the world.
Yeah, to the massive corporations.
Yeah.
And there's a different way I want to kind of push you to talk about something that you covered. I don't know. It's been years ago, I think. Is volunteering for a job that you have a passion for?
Yeah. Well, this is, you know, I think the, you know, people who are just entering the workforce just don't understand just how valuable personal capital can be, reputational capital. You know, that experience that you get, the outlook on life that comes from doing real labor and work for any kind of busy environment. And it's, to me, one of the great tragedies that, you know, I mean, from a very early age, you know, the government compels our kids into kind of these prison-like situations and sits them in wooden desks and basically makes them sit there for 12 years. I mean, it's like an amazing thing. You know, okay, there's PE or whatever, and there's a chess club and, you know, whatever. And those are great. But basically, everybody's trapped. And they're not involved in this kind of world of commerce. They're not really... seeing, they're not really ever opening the door and getting outside and seeing what life is like in the adult world and what I would just call is the real world. So and it's just really a very tragic thing that's happened to youth unemployment, which is just huge. And nowadays kids don't even look for jobs anymore. They just forget, well, that's stupid, that's tacky. Yeah. I don't want to have anything to do with it. Well, you know, look, we've heard this story a thousand times. People graduate from college and they start looking around for jobs, and it turns out that they basically have nothing valuable to contribute to anybody. And that is incredibly tragic, you know, and by the time you wake up and realize this, it's really too late. I mean, it's too late for you. And then you despair, and God knows what happens. You talk to your parents giving you a long European vacation, or you go to graduate school. you can't find a job. Go volunteer, work for free. I mean, if you can do it, of course, the federal government doesn't like that either. It's a kind of a problem. It's actually tricky nowadays to get even internships you pay for. You know, it's hard, but boy, is it worth it. That's just a great way to add to your personal capital. I talk about it in my new book, A Beautiful Anarchy, all many, many different tactics here for how people can enhance their personal value using digital tools. We've been given wonderful tools these days, and people should really be taking advantage of them.
I'm going to stop you there and save this file again, and folks, stick with us through the commercial. We'll be right back. Would you like to do something to support BadQuaker.com? Here's how easy it is. If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to BadQuaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give BadQuaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon, it won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting BadQuaker.com. Thank you. Thanks for sticking with me through the commercial, folks. This is Ben Stone, Bad Quaker, back with Jeffrey Tucker. And we were just talking about volunteering and the wonders of that, and how you gain experience. And really, it's more than just getting experience for a resume. It's gaining the real experience deep inside you of knowing that you're doing something and you're accomplishing something. And that's really the beauty of business anyway, in that value that you get deep inside knowing that you've really done something and you've changed things.
Yeah. I'll tell you, it does other things for you too. It creates within you a kind of a service ethic, you know, the desire and willingness to serve other people happily, you know. And you also creates a great deal of patience. Let me quickly tell you a story. I know a 17-year-old girl who was working for, you know, volunteering, which is great. Volunteer is fine. She was working for childcare at the local church, and you know, gained some valuable experience or whatever. But you know, you could just imagine, you know, the struggles and tribulations associated with that sort of thing. But, so she quit and she went to work for a movie theater. And I had a long talk with her about what she had learned over the course of 2 months by working at the movie theater. And it was really interesting because, first of all, she seemed more alive than ever and really upbeat. Her personality had gone from sort of slightly dark to being really upbeat. She was really excited about her life and what she was doing. But I talked to her about what she had learned. And she said, first of all, I learned that there are a lot of jerks in this world. Which is true. I mean, the world is filled with belligerent jerks. I mean, it's especially the customer class these days, you know, especially just outrageous. It's funny. I mean, I wish people would be as demanding and sort of quick to explode, you know, in dealing with government bureaucrats or the TSA or whatever they are with the local movie, you know, the lady is serving the popcorn at the local movie theater. You know?
You know, but those people rarely tase you, though.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because commerce, you know, that's right. They're not tasing you, so everybody feels the freedom just to demand their way, and that's fine. But she learned also that there are also lots and lots of wonderful people in the world. So she learned both these things, and she also learned to maintain a smile and to be you know, always kind of upbeat and service oriented, no matter who you dealt with. So, in other words, it helped her grow up. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, dramatically, in the course of really just a few weeks, this is a revelation to her, you know. And also, it makes her feel good about herself, just knowing that people are coming voluntarily, giving them money, and she's helping them get their Cokes and popcorn, and they go see a show. And you know, look, I mean, to be a part of the enhancement of human well-being, that's a great thing. Yeah, you don't have to travel to Africa and give away and bring tsetse fly nets to poor tribes. I mean, there are other ways to serve humanity. It's a great thing too, but you know, serving popcorn at the local theater is a great way of enhancing human well-being. Everybody's better off after every single transaction that occurs, and you feel it, you see it. There's an upbeat sense of we're all exchanging here voluntarily to our mutual betterment, and that's an exciting world to be part of.
Recently, you wrote an article for Whiskey and Gunpowder where you were comparing the experience of going into Tiffany's with something like the TSA.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see the difference there in the attitude. But the thing that I took away from that was that you pointed out something that I rarely see anyone saying, and that is that you don't necessarily have to have a trade-off between security and human rights. You can have security without being trampled on and groped and all these things.
Yeah, you know, and it's that article came about because one of the problems is when you nationalize something as important as airport security, suddenly the vision of what could be an absence of the bureaucratic control vanishes. You know, you no longer see it. You don't see what could be possible in absence of this static, coercive system. So you have to use some imagination. And I was intrigued. I specifically went into Tiffany's for this reason, because I wanted to see what a small shop does. That, I mean, I don't know what their inventory is like, and I tried to find out. I don't know, but I mean, the value of that inventory is, you know, huge, and the most valuable parts of that inventory are inevitably on display, because that's why you're there. You're there to see the jewels, you know, and there they are. So you don't want to feel a sense of I mean, if there were loudspeakers blaring and Tiffany's that said, if you see something, say something, you know, that would be a little bit unpleasant. Do you know what I mean?
It wouldn't inspire you to spend $100,000 on a bracelet.
No. Or if they're groping you and patting you down and whatever. I mean, so because these things are offend people, you know, obviously. But the demands for security are very intense. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of hung around there to the point that they began to think I was a security threat. just to try to figure out how they did it. And I was intrigued at all the little things. I mean, there's a guard at the front door with a little, tiny little, you know, swirly, translucent wire sticking out of his ear. So you have the sense that he's in touch with somebody important. I mean, maybe there's a SWAT team, you know, that's going to bound out from behind the wall there, you know, with one thing that goes wrong. But you don't know that. And otherwise, he's dressed in a beautiful suit and he's extremely well mannered and he's greets you, but that thing sticking out of his ear is very obvious to you, so you're already on notice. You see what I mean? Extremely subtle, but you know, and non-threatening, but it gets the message across. Also, I noticed that the way people walk around in there, that people tend to talk softly, they tend to walk slowly, people speak with deliberation, and I think the employers are trying to be this way, to be extremely nice and respectful and deferential to the customer, but to kind of very so subtly insist on a certain mode of being, you know. But anyway, and then of course the surveillance cameras are everywhere, but they're not sticking out of walls and going following you around. No, they're in these little blue balls in the ceiling. They look a little bit like decorations, so you have a sense that they might be security cameras, but you can't be sure. Anyway, I'm going on too long about Tiffany's. My point is, you can't transfer that model exactly to airport security, but there are security problems in every aspect of life, and you have to leave it to the market to figure out the best way to deal with these things. The problem with the TSA isn't just that it's inefficient and belligerent and groping us and all these kind of things. The problem is that it is not creative. And it's not creative because there's no direct consumer-producer relationship there.
Yeah, and I would also make the argument that it actually doesn't fulfill its primary purpose. I would argue that I wrote an article some time back called The Dog in the Yard, comparing the TSA. You know, if there's really a bad guy that wants to get past TSA, he's got his whole life 24/7 to figure out a way to do it.
Yeah.
And those guys at TSA, it's just a job for them. So they're only, you know, they don't have the level of dedication that the bad guy has. So they don't really provide the security that they purport to.
No. It's all security theater, and I think everybody knows that. I mean, I've never really feel secure. And they're always telling us that, well, they're doing this for our benefit, you know, to serve it. But nobody really believes that. I mean,
yeah,
they're preventable crimes that were preventable on paper after the fact, and jumping through a series of hoops and things like this. You know, I mean, when my bottle of cucumber vodka was confiscated, and I felt like a fool for having brought it in, I thought, you know, this is sad. The lady who took it from me was sad. I was sad. Everybody was sad. But hey, you know, there's the rules. It's all kind of pathetic. And it's not responsive. And anyway, so, you know, I don't think when people talk about the TSA, libertarians need to be a little bit careful not to pretend as if they have all the answers. Or like the TSA is doing it the wrong way. I know how to do it the right way. Well, we don't really know how to do it the right way. And one of the reasons we don't know how is because we're not letting the market solve the problem through its normal, you know, that aspect of play that comes with market creativity, you know, the trial and the error, the give and take. That whole feature of what makes life develop, makes the world progress, that whole feature, that engine of civilization is not functioning within the TSA. That's the problem.
It's very much like what you were talking about rock climbing there. It's the mystery and the beauty and the artistic aspects of business that drive things like that, that produce the result that Tiffany's has there, where you absolutely are secure at Tiffany's.
Absolutely secure. And it was funny because I was asking so many questions about it. It's like I asked the guard, I said, tell me this, are you armed? And he looked at me like, that is not the kind of question I'm here to answer. And it really isn't. It is. It's none of my business. You know, as I was explaining, I was writing an article, and he's thinking, "Yeah, likely story."
Let me, if you don't mind, let me take you back to an old article you wrote a long time ago, but it sticks with me, and I think of it pretty regularly, and I even refer to it here on my. Well, I actually steal your concepts. I don't actually give you credit for it, but this is the myth of the voluntary military. Mm. The idea that we don't have a draft in the in the U.S. when actually, in a sense, we very really we do have a draft.
Yeah, you know, that's right. You know, I'm sure you've had this experience too. You talk to a fine young man, you know, who's or a young woman who's, you know, intelligent and has a bright future ahead, and they say, well, they're going into the military, and oh my goodness, you know, you've probably been lied to in some way. And the recruiters are specialists in this. I've known recruiters before who just tell me this, that they couldn't in good conscience continue to trick these people the way they do. But yeah, it's especially.
So unfortunately, that was the moment that we just couldn't salvage any more of the recording. And it was very unfortunate. You know, Jeffrey had some really good things to say, and we went on and talked for, oh, I guess it was close to 10 more minutes. And it's very unfortunate. You know, I could hear him speaking, but I could also tell that there was a certain rattliness in the sound that it was that didn't sound right. But when I went back and checked the recording, it was just completely garbled, and you couldn't understand what he was talking about, which is very unfortunate. Like I said, he was really saying some good stuff. I'm going to do everything I can to try to connect back with Jeffrey and get a follow-up interview, and maybe we can take right off at the same part, at the same topic, and we'll see what we can come up with. So in a sense, maybe it's good that this one died, because that'll give me an excuse to have Jeffrey back on the show again much sooner than, you know, the year that went by since the last time he was on. So we do have a little bit of a shortened podcast today. I hope you did enjoy the time that I did get to talk to Jeffrey, at least enjoy the part that you got to hear. And that'll have to be it for the weekend. I appreciate all the new growth that we've had and new listenership at badquaker.com and the feedback that I'm getting. Again, I'm a little backed up on email, so if you've sent me email and I haven't responded to it, it's not that I'm ignoring you, it's just that I'm a little bit overwhelmed. Maybe the weekend will help me to get caught up. And I'm not sure if we're going to have a podcast on Monday or not. My wife and I are teasing the idea of taking the motorhome out and disappearing for a while. So if there's no new podcast that appears on Monday, that's why. Sorry about that. But and be sure and check the website. And sometimes there are things over there other than podcasts. I put over the when was it? Anyway, several times when I don't have a podcast up, either for a weekend or whatever the case, I'll put up a link to a YouTube video or something like that. So so it's always good to check the website now and then, and maybe there's something that, you know, if you subscribe to the feed, you wouldn't necessarily know. It's according to how your subscription is done. And we're going to be changing that, too, with the updating of the website. You know, there's two different ways you can subscribe to badquaker.com. There's one way is to subscribe to the site, and you get a notification if there's any update. And then there's the other way, where you subscribe just to the feed, and you only get notified if there's a podcast. So we're going to be switching up that kind of stuff. And I should also say that if you've actually gone to badquaker.com and created a login, perhaps to... you know, to add comments or something like that. If you actually created a user ID and a password at badquaker.com, that's probably all going to disappear when we update the website. So, and the positive side there is that we're going to have some type of interactive board that's going to be there, whether it's a forum or something along that lines. So you'll be able to create a new login and password and get in there, and maybe we can have a little bit of community relationship among us. Okay, well, I'm going to wrap it up. Again, I wish I would have been able to finish off the file with Jeffrey Tucker there, but it was just not, it was just, you couldn't understand what was being said. So thank you very much for listening to badquaker.com, and for more on Liberty, the Zero Aggression Principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thanks, folks.